From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the multi-talented Tracy Letts. He's appeared as an actor in the film Lady Bird and the series Homeland. He's also won a Tony Award and a Pulitzer Prize as a playwright.
Theater, I think, presents ideas differently in a way than films do or television does. To throw a topic at somebody that they can then chew on, argue about, take a point of view on, I think that's a real valuable service we provide in the theater.
And the Grammy-nominated band Los Tex-Maniacs remakes a Woody Guthrie song. All that after this short break. My main guest today is Tracy Letts. You might know him as the actor who played the dad in Lady Bird, or this character opposite Christian Bale in the movie The Big Short.
Hi, Lawrence.
We have no confidence in your ability to identify macroeconomic trends.
You flew here to tell me that? Why? Anyone can see that there's a real estate bubble.
Actually, no one can see a bubble. That's what makes it a bubble.
Tracy Letts may often play somewhat humorless characters, but his own writing is actually very funny. As a playwright, he won the Tony and Pulitzer Prize for his family drama, August, Osage County, and his newest play, called Linda Vista, just opened at the Mark Taper Forum. It's about a man going through a divorce and an epic midlife crisis. The L.A. production of Linda Vista, which opened last night, gave Letts an opportunity to revise the play after it was first mounted in Chicago.
We premiered the show at Steppenwolf about a year and a half ago, and as a playwright, I'm always looking for that second production because there's just so much information in the first production. And inevitably, you just run out of time. There just comes a point where you say, we have to put it up. People are paying money for tickets and they're walking in the theater now, so we're done for now. But, you know, there is a process of hearing the play through the ears of the audience and sitting with it for a while and just making sure you're saying what it is you want to be saying and that you're saying it as efficiently as you might. So I really valued the time away from the play. I took well over a year off from the play before ever. I didn't look at it at all until you get it out and look at it fresh. Second production's the best.
And do you recognize those changes in rehearsal or in a preview in front of an audience? Are you sitting in the back listening to how the audience is reacting?
All of that. It's rehearsals. It's the contribution of the actors. I have a great group of people working on the show with me, not just the actors, but Dexter Bullard, the director, Ed Sobel, my dramaturg, assistant directors, artistic directors. I have a lot of people weighing in, and I'm comfortable with that. I like that process. I like people to weigh in. I'm the final arbiter for what goes on up there, but I can take all of that on, all that advice I can take on.
There's so much that an actor can bring to a piece of writing. I'm thinking about the lead character in your play, Wheeler. On paper, at least, he's a cad. He's a misogynist. He's a misanthrope. But so much of his soul is revealed by the way that he is performed by the actor in your cast. That's Ian Barford.
His name is pronounced Jan, improbably. There's no good explanation for that. It's spelled Ian, but his name is pronounced Jan. The truth is that as a writer, I put the words on the page, but one of the reasons I am a playwright is that I'm trusting that actors are going to bring humanity to the piece. I mean, you're right. On the page, Wheeler is a bit of a cad, but once he's embodied by a flesh and blood guy who's got a lot of complexity, you start to see, oh, he's not just any one thing, right? Wheeler is a lot of contradictions on the page and in the person of Jan. He can infuriate you in one moment and he can kind of break your heart the next. So I depend on the actors to bring that to bear. I know they're going to bring it to bear. It's why they're there. Jan is a fantastic actor and he's absolutely the right actor for this piece. He sits in his middle age in kind of a profound way, really. He's got such facility with my dialogue and with Wheeler's sense of humor. He's a guy that an audience hates to love or loves to hate, depending on what seat they're sitting in.
A lot of this story is about what it means to be middle-aged and what it means to have made choices that have consequences and about how you look at yourself at a certain point in your life. I want to ask you to read a section between Wheeler and a woman named Jules, and it's about ambition. Wheeler, we know, is a photographer or was a photographer. I guess Jules thinks that he still can be and should be a photographer. If you don't mind reading this passage from the play.
So Wheeler says, "I'm a camera repairman." And Jules says, "You know I don't like it when you say that. It's so completely true. You have a higher calling." He says, "Is Jesus coming for a visit? You know something I don't?" She says, "I've seen your pictures, babe." He says, "You've seen maybe 5 photographs out of the tens of thousands I've taken." She says, "You have a unique talent. You capture something essential." He interrupts her. "You don't know what you're talking about." She says, "Let's just agree to disagree." And he says, "No, let's just disagree."
It's a really profound moment in the play because he is trying to figure out who he is, what he should be doing. And I think it's something that everybody of a certain age goes through. Is this my life?
Right. Plays can sometimes reveal themselves to you. Your larger concerns start to appear like invisible ink that suddenly starts to appear on the page. And I became aware at some point that the play for me was about seeing. It was about perception. It was about our ability to see other people and certainly our ability to see ourselves. And Wheeler is a guy who, whether it's an excuse or reasonable explanation, has not been able to see other people or see himself for a very long time. And so, you know, the truth is it's hard to do as a human being, and it takes some self-awareness, some work. It takes work to be a more fully realized person. Once that starts to reveal itself on the page, and then I can comb back through the play and say, "Oh, there I've been writing about this all along. This thread was in here from the beginning all the way through."
Coming up, more with actor, screenwriter, and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Tracy Letts.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
And now let's get back to my conversation with playwright, screenwriter, and actor Tracy Letts. He often goes back and forth between theater, film, and television. He's garnered many awards for his stage work, including a Tony and a Pulitzer for writing August Osage County. He also won an acting Tony for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. His new play, Linda Vista, just opened at the Mark Taper Forum, and it focuses on a smart but caustic man named Dick Wheeler, who's dealing with divorce, middle age, and a whole lot more. We pick up our conversation with Letts, talking about where his characters come from.
As a playwright, part of my job is observing people around me, hopefully observing them with some compassion and the ability to write about them or their point of view, not in an uncritical way, but again, in a compassionate way. That is one of the things I like in particular about this play is that Wheeler, as I say, he's a complicated guy. There's a lot of contradictions in him. But I don't think the play or the other women in the play let him off the hook. And at the same time, it's not just a takedown of that guy. That would be easy to do, too. I think there's some compassion shown to that guy.
I want to follow up on that because I think you bring up a really interesting point. And I'll be very vague because I don't want to give away anything material. But there's a scene in the play where a man has treated a woman badly, and he asks her for a little bit more than forgiveness. And I was watching this scene, I was thinking, don't let this be the way that almost every male writer writes this scene, which the woman says, sure, whatever, because you don't do that. And it's very clear that you make the choice of the way most women would react to that situation and what they would say. And it's gratifying, not so much for what she does, but also what she doesn't do, is fall into the cliche of the male writer fantasy.
Yeah, well, you know, there are four female characters in Linda Vista. I think they're well-drawn characters, and I have some exceptional actresses playing these parts. And as I say, everybody contributes to this process for me. And these women were huge, monumental for me in creating this work, in the humanity they brought to this, and their ability to voice their own experiences in rehearsal throughout the process and say, these are things that have happened to me. This is these are things I've done. These are things I've said. These are things I wish I would have said at other times in my life. I have to say, though, you know, we start talking about this in terms of gender. We start to break this apart as opposed the men as opposed to the female characters. The truth is, I've had a lot of women who have seen this play who identify as much with Wheeler.
I've heard that. I've heard that a lot.
As they do with the women in the play.
I think it's absolutely true.
Disrespecting each other in our gender relations is not specific to any one gender, and there's nothing new about it, unfortunately. It's been around for a long, long time.
We don't.
I don't want to go out with you.
I'm getting that.
I don't have to explain why. I mean, I don't owe you an explanation.
You don't owe me anything. It's because I'm old, right?
We love you.
Come on, you're skeeved out because I'm old?
Yes, you're too old.
Okay.
You're way too old.
Okay. I mean, I'm not like the Crypt Keeper, am I?
Oh my God.
Just tell me you think of me like the Crypt Keeper.
What is the Crypt Keeper?
Linda Vista is an actual neighborhood in San Diego. At what point did it become the setting for the story? Did you start with play, start with character? What was the genesis of the idea of Linda Vista, the play?
It's so unusual for me. Normally, I think about a piece for years before I start writing it, and then I write it very quickly. Linda Vista was different in that I rolled a page in the typewriter and just started typing. I didn't really know what I was doing. It's a free writing exercise. I think most writers do it, just a way to maybe start writing in the morning or get your fingers moving on the typewriter, whatever. And it turned into a piece of dialogue between a couple of guys, and that piece of dialogue grew from there into a play. Why I chose Linda Vista in particular? Oh, man, it's a long, multi-part, boring answer. So,
is it a place you'd visited? Is it something about that neighborhood? Or
I had been to San Diego. It was not a place I had visited prior to writing the play, though I did go there after I started work on the play and realized I wanted to set the play there.
We're talking with Tracy Letts about his play, Linda Vista, which is at the Mark Taper Forum. I want to ask you about another scene in the play. This is between Wheeler and his best friend, Paul. Because these are people of a certain age in their 50s, they're starting to think about what's next and how they will be remembered and regrets. And this is the conversation they have about their last moments alive, if you wouldn't mind reading this conversation.
Well, Wheeler is making the point to his friend, Paul, who is married, that whatever else one might say about marriage, he says, when you're on your deathbed, you'll have Margaret, your wife, too. And Paul interrupts him and says, I have had it with the deathbed. We burn a lot of fuel thinking about the deathbed. How long do you plan to spend on your deathbed? A day? A week? Maybe a couple of months at most? You got a whole lifetime before you get to the deathbed. Maybe live your life the way you want and just accept that the deathbed is not going to be the high point. You're all alone on your deathbed? Cheer up. You're about to die.
Your characters are very clever, and it's very funny. There's a lot of humor in this play, even though it's about, ultimately, some difficult things. Is that part of what you enjoy about writing, is that, this person gets to say the thing that I wish I'd said because I wasn't clever enough in the moment when it happened?
Yeah, probably. I mean, the truth is that the jokes are there to keep people listening to the play, right? I mean, it's not only my mode of expression, but it's a way that you keep an audience awake and engaged and entertained, because let's face it, entertaining them is job one. And I'm asking them to sit there and pay attention to my play for 2 hours and 40 minutes. I mean, you know, August Osage County was 3.5 hours. You'd better find some reason for people to keep their seats and listen to what's going on in the play. So that's where the humor comes from for me. As far as wishing I had said something in the moment, oh my God, don't we all wish we could go back and say something different than whatever it is we said.
This play, like a lot of your writing, leaves audiences with a lot to talk about and argue about and debate as they're leaving the theater or when they get home. If you are, by chance, in the restroom and somebody's coming out of your play and you hear people talking about it, what are the most gratifying conversations that you tend to overhear?
What I love hearing is that people are talking, debating, arguing about the play, and that sometimes I hear back from them that that argument went on not only to the parking lot, but went on the next day or maybe a couple of days after that. I mean, we get to do that in the theater. The theater, I think, presents ideas differently in a way than films do or television does. To throw a topic at somebody that they can then chew on, argue about, take a point of view on, I think that's a real valuable service we provide in the theater. You know, we had in one of the early previews, there's a point where a woman is expressing some hard truths to Wheeler. And there was a woman in the audience who was applauding and cheering her on. I mean, she was very vocal in her approval of what the female character had to say. And, you know, I just had to remind everybody the next day that, you know, catharsis is one of the things we provide in the theater. And I think she was having a cathartic moment. And I absolutely embrace and accept that. You know, we seat 700 people in the Mark Taper Forum. There's room for all sorts of responses and points of view.
I want to ask you a little bit about how you balance time as a playwright, as a screenwriter, as an actor. Do you compartmentalize? Do you do one thing at one point and then move on to the next? Or you try to do multiple things at multiple times?
No idea. I don't know how the hell I'm doing it. I'm exhausted. That's how I'm doing it. I'm exhausted. I enjoy all of the things I work on. Time management is, I'm sure I'm not the only person in the world it's an issue for, but I don't necessarily have a plan. I mean, obviously I'm here working on Linda Vista, so this is my focus right now. I start rehearsals for a play as an actor at the end of February, doing All My Sons on Broadway, and my focus will be on that.
Is performing a show on Broadway different than being a show at a regional theater, doing something at Steppenwolf?
Well, first of all, Times Square is a nightmare. That's one of the biggest differences. That's such a pain in the ass to go to Times Square 8 times a week to do a show. And Times Square is loud, too. When you're doing a play, you can hear
every ambulance, every car honk, I know.
I remember once we were doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and it was a particularly loud night out on the street, and I came off stage. I was just furious, and I said, my God, it's like trying to do a play. And Carrie was standing there. She said, in Times Square? I'm like, yeah, maybe this isn't the best place to put a theater district. It's great to perform shows on Broadway because you feel like you're almost part of a festival or something, the festival of that moment, whatever the other plays are going on Broadway in that moment. You feel real camaraderie with the other people who are on Broadway. So I love the fellowship of that. It's a great feeling.
Tracy Letts is the playwright of Linda Vista. It's at the Mark Taper Forum through February 17th. Tracy, thanks for coming in. Great to see you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Lyle Lovett teams up with Los Tex-Maniacs to revive a Woody Guthrie song. Among the 2018 Grammy nominees in the category of Best Regional Mexican Album is the band Los Tex-Maniacs. They already have one trophy for their 2010 album, Borders y Bailes. Borders are again the theme of the band's latest record that's up for a Grammy. It's called Cruzando Borders or Crossing Borders. It's a diverse collection of covers and original songs about the migrant experience, Mexican-American identity, and more. Among the highlights is a cover of the Woody Guthrie song, Deportee. It tells the story of a little-known plane crash near Fresno that resulted in the deaths of 28 migrant farm workers who were being returned to Mexico in the winter of 1948. Guthrie wrote Deportee as a poem and never recorded it himself, but after Pete Seeger recorded it in the 1960s, it quickly became a folk music staple. The song has since been covered by Johnny Cash, Joan Baez, and scores of other artists. For its version of the song, Los Tex-Maniacs recruited singer Lyle Lovett. The founder of Los Tex-Maniacs, Max Baca, tells us the story behind Deportee and how it fits into the larger story told in Cruzando Borders.
My name's Max Baca, and I am the band leader of Los Tex-Maniacs, and I play the bajo sexto, and I sing. Bajo sexto is a 12-string guitar with bass strings and guitar strings. The strings, the gauges of the strings are a little thicker or bigger than the regular guitar. So it's kind of has a more of a midier, bassier tone than a regular guitar. So it's got this really attractive sound when you play it. They call it the grizzly bear of all guitars. It just growls.
One, two, three.
Well, I formed the band in 1997, I guess, around there. Prior to that, I was a bajo sexto player with the Texas Tornadoes, so decided, okay, well, we're going to kind of like the Tornadoes thing, but our own thing with more of the traditional, you know, instead of branching out too much into the rock and roll. And it's a great unit, man. We're having a lot of fun right now and just so excited about this Grammy nomination, and it's really just an honor. First time I heard Deportee, I had got invited to do a project called Los Super 7, and of course I heard it through Arlo Guthrie and with Woody Guthrie. At the time, I didn't really pay attention to the lyrics, but after it was recorded and then I sat down and really listened to the original version, I was like, wow, it's got a strong message.
Now some of us are illegal and others not wanted. Our work contract's out and we have to move on.
What I've gathered from it, you know, listening to so many times, yeah, it's migrant farm workers that were in California working and then getting deported back to Mexico when the plane crashed in that Los Gatos Canyon out there.
We've died in your valleys, we've died on your plains.
The Immigration Service loaded a DC-3 with men and women headed to Mexico, most of them at the end of a season of farming as part of the Bracero program for guest workers. When the plane crashed near Coalinga, newspapers named the four Americans on board. They simply listed the 28 Mexicans as deportees.
These migrant farm workers were working the fields and trying to better their lives or whatever, you know, and just working hard, honest working. Then there's a plane crash and they all get killed.
The crops are all in and the peaches are rotting.
We decided to get somebody that can really deliver the message really nice, and we decided to go with Lyle Lovett.
My brothers and sisters come work in the fruit trees. They rode the trucks till they lay down and died.
I was interested in getting to sing Deportee for so many reasons, really. I mean, meeting Max and to be part of a project he was involved in really appealed to me. I'm, of course, a Woody Guthrie fan, and it's just one of his classic songs. And it is as relevant today as it was when he wrote it. It's an honor to sing those words.
Who are these friends all scattered like dry leaves? The radio says they are just deportees.
In the project here that we did, Cruzando Borders, we don't want to get too political, but también it's also borders across the world, you know, taking our music and crossing borders that we've never been to, places that we've never gone, and we've been blessed to have been to China several times, you know, to Mongolia, to Russia. We did four tours to Iraq during the war to perform for the troops. When you say Cruzando Borders, it's not narrowed down just to the Mexican border, you know.
I am one more lonely man, so far away from home.
Rick Trevino also wrote a song on the CD called I Am a Mexican, and it just kind of stems from that concept of deportee, you know. He's a migrant farm worker, and he's with a female from this side, and he's from the other side of the border, right? She's always getting after him, and she says, my back is wet. And you can say my back is wet, but I call it honest sweat.
She's only seeing one thing whenever she looks at me.
I am a Mexican, and God bless America. She says my back is wet. I say it's on the sweat. I run from La Migra.
It was the right time, you know, all the political stuff that's been happening, and, you know, with the wall and with migrant farm workers, you know, migrating to America and Texas and Colorado, California, you know, Michigan, all the way up to North and South Dakota. And so I think this is the right time to do an album like that, with that concept of the hardships, and this is the hardships we've gone through. And the album is kind of based around all of that deportee thing, you know, and didn't make it too complicated, and it just fell right into place, man.
That segment was produced by Frame contributor and occasional pinch hitter, Stephen Cuevas. And that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.